give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast. Me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Mossy and Paul. This is episode 8 of season 2. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you've not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. And now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. And today I am delighted to say we are joined by Eddie Hoare, former Galway player turned city councillor and now match analyst for Galway Bay FM. You played with St. Michael's. I presume you played with Mossy at some stage, Eddie, did you?
Yeah, I would have. The blue and white of Michael's. Mossy was obviously front and centre of Michael's. I was in the younger generations coming through. So
you'd be
cross. Say a crossover about a year or two, maybe max. It's yeah.
And like you played one of the best club footballers in Galway for the last 15 years, a former schools player for St. Mary's, a Sigerson Cup player in NUIG, and also part-time Mihála Mara Hurtig impersonator. I presume that's all true to fit.
That's me. You have me in.
And this week we are watching, or we have watched, A Year Till Sunday, the story of the Galway footballers to 1998, Mossy?
98,
run to the All-Ireland final. Mossy has been pushing for this now since day one, so we're delighted to see it. So first of all, what do you think of the film, or how did it reflect real life, I suppose?
It's just the greatest ever film, isn't it? Sports documentary ever, like from my point of view, and it's just, I just love it.
Absolutely, like, and I think in a way, A Year Till Sunday is probably before its time, or well ahead of its time, like in terms of documentaries. We see them now, the Lions documentaries, various different documentaries on rugby or any particular tours, but this seemed to be one of a kind. You'd always have your RTE wrap up at the end of every year and we get it for Christmas, but this was the first real interaction and taster that people would get of what it was like really to be within an intra-county dressing room. And I suppose me and Mossy, I suppose, being from Galway, we were spoilt in a way, and so far as we had so many great memories of that 98 team and what they did since. But that video must have been like in every Galway household. I'd expect the Christmas of 98, and it's been played and played and played through videos to DVDs. And just in terms of, I suppose, GAA in general, it really captures the exact mood of what it means to play for your county. And more importantly, I suppose, firstly, represent your county, but luckily for the guys that were involved to win for your county.
Yeah, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. Like and I actually watched it at the very start of lockdown, the initial one, and I watched it again there, and it's just very enjoyable. And even the name of that, A Year Till Sunday, I think that's possibly the best part of it, because like at that particular time, much like this year, it's that knockout feeling and you've one chance. And I suppose Galway have been building towards their Connacht final against Mayo for probably since late October, early November. It's over a year, you know. So just that feeling of when you lose a championship the year before and then get into the next one, like with the keeper. And I thought it was really interesting from the perspective that Pat Comer was the sub keeper filming it, and how we went into the difficulty in the 97 season and how Macker and Goal was the fallout guy for losing, you know.
So yeah. It was the sub keeper actually the filmer?
Yeah.
Go away. I didn't actually realise that at all.
Yeah, Pat Comer. He was actually a great goalkeeper. He actually played for Ireland in compromised rules back in around 1991. He was a savage goalkeeper.
It's really interesting how he ended up on the panel. So he'd been on the Galway panel in that early 90s stage and was the main man, and he ended up moving abroad, coming back and going to a different club.
Carrow, yeah. He won a Carrow.
And what club was he with before that?
Saltill, I think, originally.
Saltill, yeah, he's a Saltill guy, yeah.
So, and they ended up winning the county. Mm. And then he was called in because they hadn't got a sub-keeper for a particular match. I think it was only a challenge match. And then the manager goes, do you know what, will you stay in? And, like, because dug him out of the hall, will you stay in with us for the rest of the year, you know? And it was good.
Yeah, it was just... like you said, and Comer, you can see in some of the clips, even in Castlebar, as they go in the first round, he's in the sub bench and he's the sub keeper, but he's actually videoing. So if you see Martin Mack makes the save early on in the game, it's Decky Meehan, goodbye Mackie. Well, who's there with the camera but Pat Comer? Then in the All-Ireland final, you'd actually see, if you look very closely, you'll see the RTE camera kicks in. But if you look in, you can see Comer in it again. And again, you see him walking out onto Croke Park, the All-Ireland. Like, who gets to video that? And the roar of the crowd going out the Cusack at the Hogan stand. He's there behind his teammates going out. It's just like, has everything really in a way, you know? And
like, he struck the lottery ticket, really, didn't he? Like, Galway were a Division 3 side that year. Like, they drew a Carlo in a league match. I know it was in Tuam or something like that. And they weren't expected to do anything, really, to be honest, like, to win All-Ireland. But I'd say themselves, they always had the belief. Like, 1997, they had a great match in Tuam against Mayo. Val Daly was the manager, player-manager. And they were unlucky on the day. And Mayo went on to an All-Ireland final that year. And then 98, obviously it was 98. 99, actually, there's clips about it today. I was watching again. It's a brilliant match where Mayo beat Galway again in Tuam. Like, so it's 3 years in a row where Galway and Mayo are just, like, probably the best matches in the country. And the crowd, did you see the crowd in 99? If you look at it, it was on Facebook GA's page today. The crowd in Tuam Stadium in 99 was just unbelievable.
Not sure how many could fit in there legally.
They'd probably get 20,000, but I'd say 20,000. There wasn't the stand. There was just literally people all over the place. I remember
everywhere.
And they were literally crammed in houses everywhere on top of dugouts. But like, as well, as you said, Mossy, to go back, if you look at the video again, and Tony Davis, when Galway were playing Mayo, he did say beforehand, you could be potentially looking at All-Ireland final, because Ulster football's on a bit of a tonic.
That's right.
Won very, very well, and signs on that they did get to the final. As the video then goes on, or the clip goes on, you can see there was probably the expectation levels rose as the Bet Mayo. Mayo had taken out, had been in the All-Ireland in 96, lost a replay to Meath, lost to Kerry in the final in 97. So Galway, probably the belief you could see as the video wore on, you know, so it was intriguing in that regard as well.
But you talk as well about him hitting the jackpot, about it being 98. Like, he tried to do it in 97.
Yeah.
They were betting the first round. And like how many other examples are probably out there of these type of fly-in-the-wall documentaries where the season went shit, which would be even more riveting viewing because you'd possibly see where things went wrong. Like looking at John O'Mahony in this scenario, like, you go, like, you'd struggle to say, geez, he got that one there badly wrong at any stage in the film, you know? What could it have been like the year before with
Val Daly?
Val Daly, like, you know?
Yeah. Val is only in there for 1 year, like.
And as well, he'd got permission off Val Daly to do it, but he didn't explicitly say to John O'Mahony he was going doing it. And he just kind of done it and stuck it. He talked about going to Castlebar and being feeling a little bit uneasy in doing it as the sub keeper, being in the dressing room, everyone's fucking focused on championship, and there he is with doing this little bit of an aside, but then coming into the dressing room after that match, and sure, it like class, like.
Yeah, I suppose, like you said, the risk of being the fall guy if they had lost. I remember in part of the clip, then the All-Ireland final, and he's literally, you could hear a pin drop. You can literally hear the cutlery in the Burlington Hotel on the Sunday morning, literally when they're having their breakfast. You can see he's literally, I'd say, 5 meters or a meter away from John O'Mahony. And I'd say John was very, very close to saying, geez, is this guy's camera out again? You know, but again, they won the game. It was brilliant. But if they had lost, I'm sure he would have been under pressure. But it just, again, goes to show how good a production it was.
But again, Eddie, like, I've no doubt at some stage during the year, John O'Mahony says, get that thing out of your face. Like, without a doubt, like, obviously, the video, because they won the All-Ireland, is going to show, have a certain narrative and story throughout it. But, like, he probably has 50 hours, 60 hours of footage. If he has that rolling for a lot of the time they're out during the year, geez, some amount of footage there that could tell a completely different story.
Yeah, a lovely part of it as well, for, I suppose, from a Galway perspective and the history is, it starts off with Sean Purcell and Jaff Allen speaking about Sean Purcell coming in, or him going in, delivering the post to Sean Purcell's chopping tune, and I'm talking about the 98, and then it goes full circle to All-Ireland final day, and Sean Purcell is literally in the restroom, I'd say 2 months or 3 months later, holding the standing wire for him, like, and he's probably one of Galway's biggest legends, and you know how big of a legend Jeff Allen will be as well. It's just, it was a bit of a plot in the whole story as well, and which was nice.
Yeah, the little things you spot every time you watch it, you see something new. Like, it's like that, like when Ja is in the post and he's talking about loves to be, being a legend around here. And then, as you say, with Sean Purcell then in the dressing room at the end of the All-Ireland final, it's just class. Like,
and you just the Donlan's then as well, and Michael Donlan saying how much it would mean the grandfather, his father had won the All-Irelands. And like, that's Bernard Brogan. That's it. That's everyone that's father has won something. I'd say like you could recreate that in a lot of dressing rooms, you know, but that's literally what it meant to him, the weight of history. And often they say in county dressing rooms, what's your why, or why do you do it? And for Michael Donlan, obviously it was his grandfather and his father had done it before him. For Jeff Allen, it was growing up in Tuam, looking at how much of a legend Sean Purcell was. So it's, I love them few bits that they capture, you know, and Ray Silk then on about to Heller to Connacht or passing the Shannon. It's some things that people who wouldn't be involved in football would never realise, but us as football addicts, I suppose, would, you know, just the importance and significance of it. But that's, again, just small little bits that they capture, you know, the Sean O'Dopeyre speaking of how he eats, drinks and sleeps football and what he watches. And back then, probably wasn't so normal, but now we know the preparation that goes into GAA and everything, you know. So it's again, going back to it, I think it was ahead of its time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think in it as well, Michael Donlan comes across just so likable, and like he just comes across as a pure young fella who just wants to go and play football, and there's a real vulnerability there that he's extremely open in how he talks to the camera, you know, and it really endears you towards him, like. He was some footballer, like he was class.
Yeah, the start of the All-Ireland final in particular, the couple of runs he made were just.
He was under pressure that year at the start of the year because he wasn't playing well, even like down in the Mayo match. He, you know, the people said, he's only playing because his father and his grandfather and stuff like that. But like then, Roscommon, the goal sort of, you know, started him off. But once he got to Croke Park, he was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Like, geez, he was like, even after 98, and you go on to other years, like there was a goal there against Kerry. Was it 2002 against Kerry? He caught a ball in midfield and he just rained it. And unbelievable at Croke Park. He was just like, and the fella, he finished at 25, 26 years of age.
Was he done?
With a hip injury. Yeah, with a hip injury.
He finished in 2000 and he captained Galway in 2006 and he retired after that year with a persistent groin injury. He won in All-Ireland.
With Salted.
6 against Galls.
Yeah.
I think he didn't play very little after that. Another part of it as well that I thought was, again, I suppose reflects the GAA's, the national anthem when it's literally being sung. And obviously for us, the most important day in sporting calendar is the hurling or the football final, depending on your code. But they go to New York, they go to London, they go, I think, to Killarearn, and everyone is literally just focused on that, and literally the world stops in terms of from a sporting perspective. And again, he goes back then to Jones's Road.
Yeah.
30 minutes earlier, he had crowds everywhere, tickets being bought and sold, and yet it was just empty, and all you could hear was the national anthem a few hundred yards away in Croke Park. It's just small little things. Like, it wasn't just putting a camera somewhere. There was a lot of thought and sort of thought put into it in terms of the production.
It was brilliant. Like, even like at the start, the dark nights, the dark winter train, and then it progressed. The nights got longer, and then the summer nights in the train. I thought it was really well put together.
Yeah, Silk put that well when he like talked about, like, you don't want to go, I don't want to go, but you're just dreaming of that hard ground in the summer, you know. I thought that, like, and that is what you're thinking about. Like, people don't want to be doing that hardship, but it has to be done. And I think a bit of that hardship is gone from the GAA, but it is, I think it is beneficial to be exposed to it a bit.
Absolutely, yeah. And the other thing as well, again, where you wouldn't capture, you always hear Jim Gavin and these guys on about the hard calls to make, but obviously another part of it again, and it's regardless of whether it was now, then, or whenever, the decision to pick the team, you know, and his camera is in there when he's picking the team, and he knows that he's probably 13, 14 of players are going to pick themselves, but there's a few that are miss out, and then you have obviously the subs. So John obviously speaks so passionately about the guy. Firstly, Shea Walsh, who got the number 12 jersey, and then about the guys who weren't making the subs, and the cut to Robin Doyle, who John is literally informing in training that he's not getting in. And stat, I think they go to Michael Clarty, who says there's such a very little difference between number 2, 12 and 22. And it probably is right. And I know I was involved in inter-county as well. And like a club level, fine, you'd be generally in the starting lineup, but like it's you can really relate to it as a player in terms of like the that moment when they're picking a team, or you're in contention and you might be in, you might be out. And I again, it's a part of the production that really catches home, and I think is very resonates very well with other codes and other sports.
It does say about the fine line, sorry, Paul. The fine line was said there, and it really, like, when you look back at it, Robin Doyle was originally meant to start against Mayo instead of John Dively, and he was injured. He was meant to be starting cornerback, someone else would be in the centre. And he got injured, Dively got in. And then you see later on at the end where we talked about there with John O'Mahony talking to Robin Doyle, and you can see him saying that he's not in the 24 for the All-Ireland day, and his heart just broke. But then when you see him lifting the cup, who's the fellow bawling his eyes out in delight, was Robin Doyle. Just shows that he had the heartbreak, but they're still part of the team, and it meant so much to them.
One of the biggest challenges for managers is being able to keep those players, or is it just say more about the individual player, that when you do get that heartache, if you don't make the team or don't make the panel, even tougher one of not being in the 24, like sometimes you can have players react differently to that. But obviously they were doing something there with that group that had them all together. Like, is that, like, what could that be down to?
Well, just I suppose on that point, going back to the film, and I mentioned it previously, you could see John O'Mahony speaking to Robin Doyle and speaking at length to him. And that's, again, going back to your man management, that it was John that I think informed him that he wasn't in the team. And I expect he gave a good explanation why, or his reasoning. And I think with management and players, it's very important that sort of one-to-one, that sort of interaction, that man management in terms of getting that buy-in from all the players, because it's the ones, I suppose, that are losing out the most, I think, from my own personal perspective anyways, is the ones that are on the fringes and potentially might think they should be in, but if they get a proper reason why they aren't in, I think they'd accept it more and buy into it. And that man management, I think, is definitely something that, not from my own personal experience, because I didn't work with John O'Mahony, but I'd say that he was very, very good at.
And from a player's point of view, Eddie, when it's different between county and club, because you probably have that bit more commitment maybe in a county level. But if you're being told that you're not part of the team, when is there a good time to say to a player that, look, you're not in the 15 today, or not in the 24 today? What way?
I always find, anyway, I think it's from, I suppose, county perspective, I think it's hard to gauge it. Sometimes from a county perspective, they'll always announce a team a little bit earlier, because the media will have the team anyways. And I think players alone, it's good. I think it's important that the players themselves, the ones that might be borderline, that the manager would call them, they talk to them and tease them out and explain it. And that sort of cuts it. From a club perspective, I think the early announcement is a little bit more difficult, because there's more likelihood of the team being leaked out between the one that's disappointed, whereas it wouldn't happen as such in a county because the media is going to have it anyways.
Yeah. So,
in terms of timing, from the club perspective, I think sometimes I'd have reservations about announcing it too early. But definitely the main thing, I think, from the county perspective, is that the ones that are borderline touch and go, that they're informed, and I suppose giving the heads up in advance, I think, is important. Because it's never easy. And to be fair, it's not easy on the managers either, because the ones that are touch and go are probably a lot of things they're doing very, very well that they could be in the team, you know, so it can be difficult on the manager too.
And Eddie, have you experience of a manager handling that poorly?
I wouldn't really in perspective, like, I suppose in my time in Galway, I suppose I would have been more on the fringes of the county team. And when I was in, and sometimes you were out, and generally I would have, I suppose, accepted it. You'd know, in most cases, that there'd be there'd be six forwards or whatever in that team that's probably better than you at the time, and you'd be willing to accept it. From club's perspective, then I suppose, look, I would have been involved with club for a number of years and probably wouldn't have been as, it wouldn't have been an issue as such, you know, from a club's perspective. But from a county perspective, you're surrounded by elite athletes and elite players. And generally, if you're not in the team, that you're, you can be guaranteed that the guys that are in there will do the job, you know.
That's why I also find that it's a little bit more difficult to say from a club, is that if you tell such and such on a Thursday night that he's you're not in the 15, like there's a chance that they might react badly and they might go on the piss for the weekend or whatever it is. But we're in a county team, they're more disciplined, I would say, and they'll accept it a little bit easier, yeah. Especially them touch and go ones.
And again, going back into the attitude of the players, you could see in the, again, year till Sunday, a lot of them were disappointed, but what did they do at halftime? They clapped the guys out. And that was something that we often done in Galway, or was often done in Galway down the years because of 98, I'd expect, is the subs would clap the players out, the team out. And that's a real sort of, we're behind you, let's do it, lads, you know. And that's regardless of lads could be disappointed or not, they generally join in that and sort of, I suppose, put the best foot forward for the team and for your county.
Like you could see it down in Castlebar that day from the film, like the cheering from the subs was just brilliant. Like, you know, they were so involved and like Richie Fahey nearly gone hoarse. Like, I mean, it was just, you know, they were there, like they're just, everyone had bought in and they're just like wanted to win so badly. Like, I know you'd know from playing against Mayo, like what's it like building up to a match
against Mayo, obviously. Like, and I thought Pádraig Joyce captured it quite well today. You know, he said he hated them when he played with them, but he has such respect for them now because he knows what that Mayo team has given to football in general. And I can relate to that as well, and we all can, what Mayo have given. But I suppose that deep bitter rivalry that's just there, and it's, I suppose, I remember in 2008 and in my first season involved, and Pádraig Joyce was captaining that year, and going down to Castlebar, I remember we played Mayo in a league game. Liam Salmon was over us, and we won the game by a point. It was the league, probably not overly relevant, but he said at the time that you don't realise how big of a win that is. We'll be coming down here in June or in July again, and that could stand to us. We went, I think, and won the Connacht final by a point as well, and you could see with the likes of Liam Salmon as well, you know, the history that his history with Galway football, how much it meant to the likes of him to get one over on Mayo, and especially in Castlebar. There's always a tradition as well. If you win in Castlebar, you pull in Sheridan's, or there's two pubs in Milltown where you pull, yeah. and there's a tradition that they would. And it's something that you'd sort of remember, them small things where you'd pull in these pubs and come up with the cup. It's a nice tradition and one that you'd remember. You know, it's only then you realise the significance of the victory.
Yeah. It's a brilliant rivalry, like it really
Malarkey's,
is. Like
Malarkey's is the other
Malarkey's.
One.
Yeah, but it is a brilliant rivalry. Like you go down to Castlebar in a kind of final day, and it's just like it's class. Like it really is. And out in Saltill the last couple of years, well, they haven't played now in a few years because Mayo, unfortunately. But on a nice day in Saltill, you can't beat it. Like it's just. Were you playing the time of the air show was out there that day?
I might have been minor. That was 2005. It was really hot. I was on the minors that, and Galway won the senior after it. But I remember just actually, you couldn't fit another person into Fear Stadium.
There's another, they reckon 200,000 people out in Saltill watching the air show afterwards. It was just incredible. Like, it was just memories.
But you could kind of see the rivalry. I think when they actually came out of the tunnel in Mayo, you could kind of, it was like Istanbul, like your people hanging over the edges as they were kind of coming out.
Yeah.
And like to kind of be that atmosphere. Like I don't know, is it still there with the GA? Well, obviously not at the moment, but like, is that kind of a raucous kind of crowd? Like, I don't know, is that as common anymore?
It's knockout, though, because when it's knockout, it's.
But is that different. What it's like, is that what it's purely down to?
Is that... I'd say so, and more or less, knockout is in Croke Park now. It's a bigger stadium. It's not on top, you know. Like you do have the odd good game in the qualifiers. And you'd have the good crowd, like in Newbridge there, Newbridge and Mayo and Kildare a few years ago. That was a big crowd and, you know, good atmosphere. But you still get it, but probably not as much as back then. But hopefully it'll come in.
There's so much more distractions now as well. But I don't know whether there's so much else going on back then. I suppose, like, your staple on a Sunday was literally... GA was basically where it was at. You go to your mass and your Sunday of your GA, and that's where it was at. If you're, there's so much other things to do, literally then a lot, there was so much more focus on the GA. Now you have your rugby, you have other sports as well. So it was like, I don't know if it's, not that it's that element has wilted a little bit, but just more distractions, more sports, and it's not that sort of do or die parish sort of type of atmosphere, I think, within the GA anymore. But not to say that it's still there, but just not as, I suppose, do or die as it would have been back then. Yeah. I don't know, in terms of like from a life's point of view, you know.
Yeah, you have the safety net. Really, like if Cork won that match yesterday, but there's a back door, would it have been as wild as celebrations?
Probably not. Yeah. Now the other thing that kind of stuck me as well early in the thing during the, let's say, the Connacht Championship was like, it took two games to beat Roscommon, and you know, they barely scraped over the line in the end. But even going back to the Mayo game, like the game hinged on one or two things to happen. Like, so you'd Max save, which went up the field, and Derek Savage got the goal shortly afterwards. And even the time Kieran McDonald hit the crossbar, Mayo went up the field and got a point, you know. And it could be like, as you said, Paul, like 97, it could have been a lot of good footage just thrown on a scrap heap because we lost the first round. But like, do you think Roscommon had they much more of an improvement? If they did, I'm just like, purely, you know, look, Roscommon haven't been in Ireland final in a long time. But if Roscommon had won the Connacht final, let's say they would have beaten Derry as well. Did they have the same scope for improvement that Galway had? So what did John O'Mahony get out of Galway extra that got them the W at the end? Like,
I think myself, and that point, I think Galway got caught a little bit on the hop against Roscommon, and we've seen since then, I suppose, Roscommon went on and won a Connacht title in 0-1. That was a good Roscommon team, and probably Galway underestimated them a little bit. In terms of whether Roscommon would have gone on and won the All-Ireland, I don't know, but I'm not so sure they would have personally. Yeah. I just don't think, from Galway's perspective, it was like as if the likes of Michael Dunn and the likes of Pádraig Joyce, Jaff Allen, it was like these guys were made for Croke Park, and they sort of became alive. It didn't daunt them one bit. If anything, when they went to Croke Park, they became... They owned it, whereas a lot of smaller counties might be inclined to go within their shell in Croke Park. And you could just see, even from the history, or even after that 2000-2001, Pádraig Joyce and Michael Donnan, it's like Croke Park is where they were meant to be. They obviously went through the nursery in St. Gerlitz. They would have played in an All-Ireland final in 94. So these guys were... well, winners, there were winners really, like, and they were made for the big stage and signs on. And some, maybe it was the history of Galway football. You could sort of see that it was something that Galway had done before and were able to do, you know. And I'd expect when we bet Mayo, you could see the excitement levels. We bet Leitrim, struggled against Roscommon, got maybe a little bit of a kick, but you could see even in all the clips, John Dibley speaking, John O'Mahony, it's nothing unless we win it. Because if Roscommon had won it, would they have been saying the same? They might have been potentially happy with a Connacht final, but Galway weren't. Mm. When they won it, they want it more, and signs on, they got it.
Jeez, and they were lucky that day against Roscommon and Tuam. I've seen Gary Fahey kick a ball twice in my life. One was that big kick up the field where they got the free, and another one was in Tuam Stadium where he tried to kick it and went 30 yards over the sideline. And he's just to be a great man, just catch it and lay it off. Just knew his limitations. But again, they were lucky to get out of Tuam that day. And the game down in the Hyde went to extra time as well. Like, it was a good Roscommon side. It was a good bust.
As you talk about kicking there as well, like, John Dibley kicked the ball away some amount during the film. Like, and it's funny because, so obviously, now Dibley's pedigree and he's involved again at the weekend. Like, he did kick the ball away a lot, but in the final, he ended up kicking the ball up the field for Joyce's goal.
Yeah.
You know? So it was really interesting, just the different style of play and the impression you might have of somebody and how they play the game, you know?
Yeah, and an interesting point on that, like, and we often see the famous clip of 2003, I think, where Tyrone absolutely take over Kerry and Darrow Canadian, they're all there. Spillane calls it puke football, and they're all on about the blanket. But if you listened to the clip John O'Mahony in before the Kildare game is on about blanket defences, and no one ever spoke about a blanket back then. And I think part of their game plan was that time was deliver the ball long to beat the blanket. And like that goes back into John O'Mahony. A lot of people like a really good man manager, but tactically quite shrewd as well in terms of what he wanted to do. He mentioned the speed in the Galway team, that they could catch the likes of Glenn Ryan and these guys on the counter-attack. So playing into the speed. But I thought it was quite funny when I looked at it again in more detail over the weekend that he mentioned blanket, because we hear that now, blanket defence. But back then, it wouldn't have been a common word used in the media, yet John O'Mahony had more or less christened that particular style of football. And it was that delivery from Dibley that ultimately won the game for them, the long ball that broke the blanket and Park Joyce's in the back of the net. And again, it's them small little details that, again, the production that went into and showed us.
And it was what I liked is I like even you see, like, Donlan was so deep, he's taking the ball off his own keeper, like in the full back line, and working it up, which is good. But I like the way what part it was, Finnegan and Joyce, when he gave them, like, you go into full forward for a few minutes and you can swap whenever you want to feel like it. You know, he gave them a bit of autonomy on the field. Like, you know, he wasn't rigid in what they had to do. Like, I thought Trout, like, he came across as a brilliant, brilliant manager. Like, he was everything. He was the manager, he was the coach, he was the team psychologist. He was everything there. Like, he was just...
And he showed probably confidence in himself that he allowed Pat Comer to do that. Probably a lot of coaches mightn't have that confidence to have someone in there. And ultimately, obviously, they'd be keeping secrets or whatever, but he had that confidence to be able to allow O'Mahony. I think another guy that actually, I know Pat Comer was... Pat Comer played and he was a sub-goalie in video, but Tommy Gorman, the Northern Ireland correspondent for RTE, he was heavily involved as well with video that year as well. So it's an interesting one. I think he knew John Nathy. So again, he was a good guy to have on board, and I'm sure very, very well-read operator.
Very good.
Like, you talk about that, given the players' ownership, and like you talked about switching from corner forward to full forward. Also, after the draw in Roscommon game, there was a good bit of training ground footage there, and like, he was allowing the players to talk and discuss things out and letting them feed back in. And like, Dively was a young lad at that stage. And as you said, he'd only just broken into the team, but he was providing him with the voice to give feedback, because like, they're the fellas on the field doing it. And I really did think that was, again, a really strong show of management and leadership from O'Mahony. Like, and like, when you hear talk of like the best coaches and managers of all time, O'Mahony probably doesn't get mentioned as much as he should do. Like, Galway were at a really low ebb in terms of, like, what was it, 32 years since they won in All-Ireland?
One Connacht final in 8 years.
10 years, yeah.
Yeah, and Phil talked about that as well, it being a disgrace that that's where it was. And, like, the fact, like, he won at Connacht with Leitrim, and then he won multiple more with Mayo, like, he's been extremely successful. And there was an interview with him at one stage as well, and so obviously with him being a Mayo man, and he was asked the question, would you give up your two All-Irelands with Galway for one with Mayo? And he says, absolutely, under no circumstances, because like, it was the players who won them, and like, the what they achieved and what they gave to win them All-Irelands couldn't be disputed by me saying, oh, sure, I'd give it up for that. So like, there's a real, real integrity to him, and just I think players buy into him because of the type of character he is. Like,
yeah, and even when he holds up the papers and that, and he says Galway not capable of winning quality possession, or very Galway fancy dance, and he doesn't claim to be a Galway man. He said, look, I'm a Mayo man, but I've a fierce loyalty to this group, and I'm hurt by that, you know. And there's one effing answer for that, you know. It's another great clip, but it's John O'Mahony, I think, at his best as well, just knowing what strings to pull on the players and ultimately getting the response, you know.
Yeah, from the perspective, then, like, when they got to the All-Ireland final, and he was telling them, I think it was the All-Ireland final, he was like, lads, get someone to answer the phones, your phone for the week, stuff like that, you know. Like, I presume, like, experience would be guiding behind that. Like, are these, like, I'd imagine that 89 when they lost with Mayo, that maybe some of these things, maybe he didn't tell the lads that, and maybe that there was a bit too much distractions. But he was fairly adamant when he was talking to them, like, this is what we're doing for the week. And he didn't kind of, I suppose he took away the autonomy of the players in that regard, where they could be easily thwarted. But he was very adamant about a couple of things. And like, I presume from his own experience, that's where it came. Like, that from being with Leitrim in 94, being with Mayo in 89 in the All-Ireland final and stuff like that. Like, that obviously has to help him as a manager going back again.
I'd say he had that the experience I'd expect stood to him. And I'd expect that from Mayo's perspective in 89, the euphoria, I suppose, surrounding Mayo would normally be bigger than a lot of counties. And I'd expect that he felt that was a big advantage for Galway going in, because he knew a lot of the pressure, the weight of expectation was going to be on Kildare. A lot of the media had backed them. And I suppose, like you said, the small things of keeping away from the phones, keeping away from the outside attention, he probably knew that that was a big, I suppose, advantage they had over Kildare in terms of the drain of Lily beat Marion Sam, and the like. Kildare had beaten Dublin, they'd beaten Meath, and they'd beaten Kerry. So they'd beaten the winners in 96, 97, and 95, 96, and 97 on the route to the final. Like, all they had to do in their eyes was just show up, to turn up, and signs on. Again, they captured the footage of your man, we're here for you. Yeah. Have to turn up, but he eats his chip or whatever. And that was the. That was the mentality, I think, in Kildare at the time. And I think John O'Mahony, as you said, going back to don't answer the phones, he was really, I'd say, trying to guard the players against any distractions, because he knew that was a very, very big, and as you said, probably from his experiences with Mayo in 89, where maybe the furore surrounding the final maybe took over and Cork then swooped in.
I know it was a good Cork team anyway, like, you know, it was our fucking best team we ever had.
Due diligence here.
It just as well in that, like, and you talk about experience, and there's a lot of other managers and teams who've been around, and they've been around finals and different things for a long amount of time and haven't got the win. Experience is only important and only is a benefit to you if you're a reflective coach and a reflective practitioner, where you're willing to do that 360 review on, well, how did it actually go? Not looking for excuses, trying to find the reasons why you lost, you know. And I think that subsequent post-season review isn't widely enough done by a lot of coaches and managers, and should be done at all levels, because there's always a huge amount of opportunity for getting better the following season by reflecting on how you went in a particular year.
Yeah, it's something that coaches and managers should definitely do. Like, I think a lot of the times the season ends sort of on a downer, except for maybe one team who actually win the cup or win the county championship, whatever it is. So you don't really want to be thinking about it. Or where did we go wrong? You want to forget about it and put it in the cupboard and speak about it again to start the next season. But I think once your season finishes, give it a couple of days, maybe a week or so, meet up with your selectors, meet up with your coaches, and reflect on the season that's just went by. What went well, what went wrong, what we can improve on, what things that can we do different to improve the team. I think it's that time of the year is vital, just as fresh in your head.
Yeah, and like, and even that, like, for a player's perspective as well, is it important that players have a reflection themselves? Internally, like, but is there
shadow of a doubt.
Is there anything that you could do or advise players to do, Paul, or is there anything that you've seen done in that regard?
Like, a lot of players at different levels now are taking a record of what they're lifting in the gym, how quickly they're competing, running times, how they're performing in the basic skills. Like, a lot of players and at club level are doing that. So there is that, like, if you go and you have a look back and you have them collated diaries, it's very easy to see, are you progressing or stagnating year on year, you know? Particular experience with that.
I suppose, look, and again, from transition from Intercounty in 08 with Liam Salmon to with Kevin Walsh, and you could see the transition in terms of the professionalism, and like, obviously the mobile phones became more popular and you're literally logging everything. There was a Metrofit app that came in and you would literally log how many hours sleep you had, what quality of sleep from 0 to 10, how many liters of water you drank, your carbs, protein, fats, intake, then various different, and that's all on the app. It's churned out, and that just doesn't go somewhere. An analysis coach will break it down and analyze it for you. And then you have your Huddle was another app that we used, and that again, in the early days, it might have been a YouTube clip or a video clip of the full game broken down into segments, but the Huddle would literally break down every time you touched the ball and every part you had to play in the game. And obviously it's come to another level again with the GPSs in terms of on-field, but the off-field is very much monitored now, and it's part and parcel of I suppose how the game has come so elite. But going back to your Year Till Sunday as well, and we talk about how elite and how professional the game has become, but you listen to Kevin Walsh back then, and he was a guard at the time and newly married with a child, and he said it's from work to home for an hour to train and to work. So even back then, while we were 22 years ago, it was still so elite at the time, even though it will show you where it has gone now in terms of the progress that the game has made in that 22 years versus the time was put in then. So it will show you that how much and how advanced the game has come since then when you consider the time and effort and energy that went in back then compared to now. And we know, as he said, he barely had a minute to go home to his young child versus now, where it's probably pretty much, I'd expect, 7 days a week, and that's spring, summer, winter and autumn.
Yeah, and Eddie, just going back on what you were saying there about Huddle and Doza, how did you find him as a player? Did you find him like that? That like was it mentally draining to be constantly doing it, or was it something that you kind of embraced and looked, you know, like when you were getting fed back to your information, you felt it was worthwhile and stuff?
Yeah, I found them useful, and I suppose you were in that environment and you just literally, it was something you did, like turning off your alarm in the morning, you literally just filled it in. And the Huddle and that, in terms of your plays and what you did well and did bad, I suppose players embrace professionalism within a setup, and when that level of, I suppose, structure is there, the players will buy in and will feed into it. And I think it all bodes better for a better setup. You can see it even in clubs now, the analysis and the detailed preparation for games, that as well. For instance, you're playing Mayo, let's say on Sunday, you're Colin Boyle, various different defenders, you have their clips from the last 3 to 4, and that's literally drilled down. That takes time and effort, but again, it's how professional the game has gone. And really, when you're in the intercounty environment, you don't really switch off. You're in a bubble. You don't, very little socializing, very little goes on, and you're so focused on what you're doing or what you're training and what you're doing the night. The days you're off, you're thinking of training. The days you're training, you're thinking of training. It's a full time, and you're sort of in a bubble, and you think, you don't really think outside it, to be honest, and you think no different. When I've come and stepped back from it and come out of it, the way I look back and say, how did I give that time? No, I wouldn't take any of the years back, but it's crazy the amount of time. But I think you're in a psychological bubble whereby you know no different, and you're just literally competing. If you're not competing for a place on Sunday, if you're not competing for to stay on the panel, to make an impression for the winter, you're literally going through cycle after cycle within that bubble, and you don't leave it really, and you know no different. So come back to your question, do you get benefit from it? I think you would get benefit from it, but as I said, you're sort of in that cycle whereby if you'd be concerned if you weren't doing it that you'd just miss out and you wouldn't be there anymore, you know.
And how important was your downtime during the season, as in terms of, like, I know Kevin watched the last few years, like they had their Friday nights as your family night. Mm-hmm. Just forget about football. How important did you take that, or was that something that was offered to you through your county managers? Or
the longer, I suppose, I was in it, in terms of from the later years, it just became the hours and hours built up. And I was probably lucky. I was working in Galway. My employer was very obliging in terms of being able to leave for training at 5 o'clock. The very little downtime in it, to be honest. And you can say downtime, but you're in the zone. You're still thinking of that training session on Sunday. If it's downtime on a Friday, you won't be, there's no out really. I know, yeah. In 2008, you might go after a league game, you generally go out, you train on Tuesday morning, but that sort of whittled out a little bit because the standard, I suppose, with Dublin and these guys bringing it to a new level, it whittled out. But in terms of downtime, I think it is very, very important for players, in terms of from the you can see now players, that probably longevity of some of the players isn't there because they're so full on, and it's just very difficult. And now you're seeing more teachers, maybe students and younger guys that are able to last the pace of intercounty, and the age profile is reducing, and that's probably why. And it's only the elite ones, your Michael Murphys, your real all-stars that can keep it going, because they have the luxury of being able to say to, let's say, to Jim McGuinness or Bonner, okay, I'm taking this winter off, I'll see you in March. Whereas some of the fringe players wouldn't have that luxury.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, it the elephant in the room, like, is Intercounty has spiralled out of all control, like, and a lot, not a lot, but an amount of the stuff that's there and players are expected to do, are they contributing to a better performance at the end of the day? Possibly not, you know, and that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, fully switched on, that isn't good for the players' performance on the pitch or their life off the pitch, you know. So, like, it can't be all, oh, do X, Y, A, B, C, the whole way down to Z, like, you know. And, like, was there anything that at a different stage you thought, why are we doing this? Like,
yeah, not really, to be honest. You were there ultimately to win in All Ireland, and you sort of had that fixation, that sort of, I suppose, obsession with just doing that and winning in All-Ireland. And that's why you were sort of in it. And just going back to your 98, I'm sure Mossy did as well, watch that hundreds of times when we were young. And literally it inspired a generation. You see Connacht Rugby winning the Pro 12. That probably is going to and has inspired a generation for rugby. But from our perspective, like, there was just that, I suppose, and I go back to it again, that obsession with it. And at times I had injuries in my early part of my career with surgery on both shoulders and issues with my back. And during my rehabilitation, it was always getting back to that top level again at Intercounty, and that drive to get back there. It's sort of, I don't know, it's a little bit, it's like a disease really, that GAA, and you get so fixated on it and that passion to ultimately win in All-Ireland. I've stepped back from it, obviously, now. And looking back in, I would have said, geez, how did I do it? But as I said, I would have never taken any of it back. Like, I was in college in Galway, probably never went on a J1, never went on any of those J1 visas, because I was either involved in a county panel or injured trying to get back into it the next year. And that's 10 years of your life that you literally give up. But ask any young lad, their dream would be to wear the Galway jersey. And that's why you do it. And that's why I have no regrets about it. You know,
and just even like you sort of mentioned it there, like that film Growing Up, like it's inspired a generation, and it's only really coming true now, I think, like the structures in the clubs. So where we're from in the city there, or just a little bit outside of me myself, like Gaelic football was never really as strong ever as it is now. And I'm not just talking about our club, I'm talking about, like, back in 98, the only senior club in this side of the county was Saltill, Killannon and Carrow. Now you have James in the city of St. Michael's, in the city of Saltill. You go out all the way out, you go Barnes, Spittle, Nabrani, Carra Road, then out the other road, then you said Uz, then you have Mike Cullen, who won the county championship this year. You have Killannon, who had captain Gary Fatty in 2001, inspired generation, Uchtarar. Like, it's really, I think, clubs got their house in order. I believe that people bought into the GA more in that part of the town, anyways, and they said, geez, that was great. What can we do? What we do? It became fashionable to send their children down playing GA, and it's paying dividends now.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, people buy-in comes, and success breeds success. And you could see that time in 98. Tuam obviously had Tuam Stadium, but Pier Stadium was idle at the time. And the success was bought into by businesses, and big businesses got involved, and people, and fundraise drive went on, and we ultimately developed Pier Stadium. But that would never have happened only for the buzz, the euphoria that surrounded the 98 guys. And they're really because of them that the likes of Pier Stadium was developed. Because, like, probably back in the early 90s, Massey, I'd expect when they Galway United won the FAI Cup, everyone wanted to play for Galway United. I know when I was growing up, all I wanted to do was play Galway football. Why? Because I remember watching the 98s, how passionate we were. Similarly, why I say Connacht Rugby again, and the Galway Hurlers probably in 2016. Young people, like, if you have an option to play rugby, play hurling, play football, definitely in that 98, it was football for me, because I suppose of what that 98 group did, you know, and that's, as a young person, you're sort of impressionable, and you'll you're sort of look up to people, and they're the guys that I definitely would have looked up to.
Yeah, and it was just like surreal, like watching that. Like I was 16 at the time, and like just a couple of years later, you're playing against these guys. Like I remember playing against Shea Walsh, the Clancy's and whatever, and like in we were intermediate club at the time, and she was like, "Geez, we're on the same pitch as these lads." Like they were heroes, but then you realize that you're up against them, and you have to play against them, and it's just like really, it was brilliant. It was a brilliant time.
You can see now, like for instance, again that 98 team, and you say, "Okay, fine." Galway football went through a lull period, but what have you now? You had Kevin Walsh was over Galway for the last 4 years, Porrick. So that team is still, it's like it just doesn't, it spirals on. The journey still goes on, and that 98 team is still given. I was involved with different managers, probably Tomás O'Flaherty, Liam Salmon, Alan Mulholland, Kevin Walsh. But all of those managers, like Liam Salmon, they had Richie Fahey involved. Tomás O'Flaherty had Sean O'Duplair, Martin Mack. You had Kevin Walsh had Brian Silk. He had, and then you had Alan Mulholland, had Declan Meehan and Paul Clancy. So all that 98 team, you have Dively now with Joyce. So they're all giving so much back as well, you know. So it's what they've done on off the pitch.
Like we mentioned that before about Clare's team from 95, the amount of players from that team who've gone on to have careers as coaches and managers. But that Galway team had loads. I can look like Martin Mack involved with Galway again this year. You have Dively. You have Jonathan Cannon, who was just on the periphery of the team. He would have played the year before. Who's probably the best of all them footballers, Joyce's and all them, when they won the Hogan Cup with Jarlitz. He's a selector this year. As I said, it's just a great link that is still in place there.
You look at the other side come Sunday as well, sure, Kieran MacDonald and Horan were playing that day in Castlebar as well. Like, and you talk about, like it's obvious the two of you grew up on this film, and it was just at that time when you were forming role models, etc. Comer was involved, and I just read an article there during the week, Comer was involved as a goalkeeper coach with the Galway Miners in 2016. And at one stage, late on in the year, they watched a DVD of A Year Till Sunday, and half them in the room hadn't actually seen it before.
Really?
Yeah, like hadn't seen it at all before. And like it just shows that different generational gap of if you don't have the heroes that you can relate to really closely, it can end up skipping a generation, you know?
Yeah, it can.
I couldn't imagine a world without A Year Till Sunday.
No, yeah, it's crazy. I'll tell you a good story about James Horan. 96.
Is this on the record?
It's on the record, yeah. 96 All-Ireland final. They got beaten by Meade in the replay, and myself and another lad went up to it on the bus. They're only young lads, about 13 or 14. Missed the bus on the way home. It's another story. But we went on to the pitch after the game. And James Horan had a great game. He kicked about 4 or 5 points, I'd say, from play. And he got beaten. And I was there. He was on the pitch smoking a fag. And so, as a young lad, I went up to him and said, "Any chance of the jersey, James?" "Hey, fuck off with you." Just...
You were lucky. That's all you got.
I know. He was lucky. He was sitting down. He's lucky. There was a big crowd around him. So I could have got a smack.
Yeah, sure, well deserved. I suppose, look, just back to the, like, there's not much else to talk about from the film. I know you two talk away for the rest of the night, but we have to rein you in some bit. But
know who the S&C coach was for Galway that year?
Strength and conditioning.
It was
Peter Warren and Stephen Joyce did a lot of the.
And Eddie Ting was it?
Eddie O'Sullivan was involved.
Eddie O'Sullivan, yeah.
Eddie O'Sullivan was, and he ended up getting the job with USA Rugby. And ended up faxing a lot of the sessions.
Yeah, no, I heard that.
It's a different world, like.
And McBurn, is he McBurn on it?
Oh, yeah, physio.
He was the physio. He did a physio with them.
World Cup, yeah.
Yeah, he did a bit of physio with them.
How was he with Galway?
I think he was friends with O'Mahony or O'Mahony knew him or something, and he brought him down, but that was some good linkage. Like, one of my favourite parts of the film was right at the end, when Micheál Gagan brought the cup out to like the west of Connemara. He couldn't get, like they say, back home, next stop Boston, all the way out to Lithiamore, and he brought the Sam Maguire into his grandfather's bed. Like, I thought that was just a special moment. Like, it was like really well done.
Yeah, and your man then says about you don't know what you've done for football in Connemara, you know, and
yeah,
he says
that's it.
Again, Zigalia, he says, and what was the other? Nilsi de Kava, Ganzi, Arsenal, Liverpool, or Man United. It was brilliant, you know. But just Connemara, like you could see, it was just alive from GAA football, you know. And
yeah,
you would have seen Carrow win in the county final. But again, it's
we
from Galway, you have your North Galway, you have your city, and then Connemara is such a proud football country as well, part of Galway as well. So that was again a nice part that was captured.
And it's a long way out. Like you go from like we would have been in the Westport, right? And you go from our pitch in the west side out to Lithuanmuir. You're taught nearly an hour, an hour out the coast,
an hour these days.
Yeah, and it's a long way out. And like the pride they have in their football clubs out there is unbelievable. And like these lads are like destroyed with emigration, like, and you know, and like a lot of their players leave, and but like the pride they have in the club is just brilliant. Like it really is good. I remember we played a minor final in 99 out in Tuam Stadium the following year, and Carrow were playing a replay against Killarearn. And you know what Tuam Stadium, the old Tuam Stadium, it's used to share the dressing rooms. So you go into the dressing room and your gear nearly be kicked out of one match into the showers. So our game was on, and the Killarearn lads had used part of the dressing room. They left their bag of jerseys. They left their bag of jerseys in the hall before the match. They're one of our players, we won't mention his name, still has Alan Kane's jersey from that county final. So I think Alan Kane had to wear a sub jersey on the day.
My God, Massey, you're after. Is that on the record?
That is on the record. And this is his name is Joseph Cork, and I can finally reveal who took the jersey.
Quick one. So the last match they played before they played the All-Ireland final, no, John O'Mahony was saying this is the last chance for a lot of you to get in. They had a beautiful set of white O'Neill's old cotton jerseys, proper retro. But do you think it was, were they actually just Galway second set, or was it specific, let's get a white set and let's beat the crap out of them because it was Kildare they were playing?
Yeah, I'd expect, and I think it would have been definitely white for Kildare, I'd say. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think so. I love the way he said as well, like, there's a fine line now between competition and picking.
Yeah.
As in, leave my 15 guys alone.
Yeah, it was.
I don't know now, but I'd expect it probably weren't. They might have been, but I'd expect it probably was because they were playing Kildare.
Yeah, they were slick jerseys. And the other thing I thought stood out as well, and if anyone nowadays is watching it, would be the, like, you know, with inter-county teams at the moment, they're so kind of regimental and military-like in what they wear and stuff like that, and you see the random club jerseys and the county jerseys, and the boys talking about the Derry jerseys. This is a proper old one, you know, and just like back in those days, having another jersey was kind of a shield to go out on, wasn't it?
Yeah, so you'd get as many jerseys as you could. So that's why I asked James Horan for his one. But I think like you can forget about your Brian Cullens, yeah, and about making Coppers famous. Like it was Shea Walsh who made Copper Face Jacks with that line. Where did you get that jersey? Copper Face Jacks. The away Derry jersey.
When you mentioned going up to players, I remember myself and Molly, I have a twin brother, and the All-Ireland in 97, the club final, and Cara Finn played Aaron Zyle. And I don't know if Charlie Redmond was suspended, or I think he was. He obviously was playing with...
It was 98. Yeah, 98.
Yeah, he must have been playing, but we went up as well. And in our wisdom, asked Charlie for his jersey after losing the club All-Ireland, and again, we got the same response he got.
Oh, I'm sloppy student as a young lad.
What was your favorite scene of the movie?
As I said, I loved the part with the cup, the Sam Maguire being brought out to Connemara. Really was a nice touch. But one of the favorite things is the lines from the whole club was about Derek Savage is the fastest man in the country. And then the young lad draws in, no, Geoff Allen is. That's the man. I thought that it was just like something you've been brought up with.
Yeah, Eddie?
Jazz the man.
I'd say my favorite part in the movie is in the film. It's a difficult one. I think probably the scene when he has the papers, the Sunday morning papers, and he says midfielders not capable of winning quality possession. Galway fancy Dans. Well, there's only one can answer for that. And cut straight to the replay and the hide. You know, I just thought that was brilliant. It was just pure raw O'Mahony, you know, and that was definitely one of the parts that I liked the best. Yeah,
Paul.
Yeah, my favorite one is probably going into the father's bedroom, but another one I really liked was the night before the All-Ireland, and they're up in Dublin, and it's flicking between the meeting and the Saw Doctors competition concert.
Near Square.
Yeah, and back to the meeting, and then Saw Doctors, and just the complete different thing that an All-Ireland means to, or just inter-county means to the players who are involved and the fans, you know, and just, they're both looking for the same thing, but they're going about it in very, very different ways.
Mm-hmm. I know
that Saw Doctors concert is just as important for the fans.
Yeah. I love the little clip as well of Dibbley, you know, where he says that O'Mahony said, this is the biggest day of your lives, it should be the best day of your lives. And then he said, we just literally walk out, the subs clapped us out, Sinead, and then they just, it happened then in the second half. And like, things like that would start to make the hair stand up in your neck, you know, and teams going out and under the tunnel for the final. That's like, going back to me, my personally, is what anyone wants to do, you know, and it's them sorts of little raw parts that they capture, I think, are brilliant. If you're Michael Donlan as well, about the running in the hail, rain, and snow, again, it's going back to what you said about he's very likable in it. He's just so such a raw young guy, just saying what he thinks rather than what he should be saying, you know.
Yeah.
And going out with the subs, clapping them out onto the pitch at that halftime, like when I was watching it, and like you're analysing it at a particular moment, and they talked about just taking the 15 in and talking to the 15 in the side room in the dressing rooms at Croke Park, and I was going, I wouldn't agree with that. But then within 30 seconds, it became evident why it was just the 15 in there, because the boys were out lining it. Like I was thinking at the particular time, that's kind of excluding the lads from what's going on. The fellas would be coming on as subs, but they had a more important role for the next 2 or 3 minutes in order to get onto the pitch. Like it's powerful stuff.
He thought of everything. O'Mahony thought of everything.
Yeah,
and that's actually funny about the 15 there. Fact from it, the 15 they started off at the first match against Mayo was the 15 they ended on the pitch against Kildare on that All-Ireland final day. Paul Clancy broke his leg against Leitrim, and he came on in the All-Ireland final for Shea Walsh at wing forward.
So they didn't get it too far wrong. So is what you're saying with team selection?
No.
I think my favourite part, as the lads probably know, I'm a bit nostalgic in these things, but when John O'Mahony was seen with a carton of milk inside after the Connacht final, inside in the dressing room.
MCF milk.
Yeah. I said, you don't fucking see cartons anymore, and a lot of young people never heard of a pint of milk either, but I just think those kind of throwbacks, you know, and even the training they were doing, like the camera was just, a lot of the time the camera was just put in the ground down by a cone, and all you can see is just legs flying by it. I just thought that was cool as well, the way it just, like, that's what they did, and that's what they had to do. When I suppose it was, a lot of the stuff was probably of that time, the coaching they were doing and stuff like that, but like as I said, look, it was just a really good, really, really good documentary. And as I said, like, from, I know Massey says it's the greatest one ever, and you say the same, Eddie, but it's definitely up there, and just from the era it came from and when it was put out, like, and to kind of have that inside guide to the team, like, I suppose it was just unheard of. It was just unheard of at the time. Like, so
that I only spot as well when I re-looked, they seemed to gatecrash a wedding in the Burlington Hotel.
That's right. Yeah.
And Sean O'Donnell had the garter, and he just cuts to one of the groomsmen or the groom, and he just is like, this is going to start off here, you know. He just he was like, where do you see a Galway team gay crashing a wedding the night before in Ireland, you know?
That's brilliant.
Do we need to rate Mr. O'Mahony, or is he getting a solid 5 out of 5 all around?
He's getting a solid 5 for me. 5 out of 5.
Certainly, yeah. Paul, and a good position as well, he was.
I give in to the peer pressure here and give him a five as well.
I'm going to stick with a roundabout with a five. Fives all around. Eddie, thanks very much. Anything else to add?
Do you want to do a quick 2 minutes? Just a quick 2 minute about the match this weekend.
Yeah, no, but people will be listening to this for the next couple of months.
I'm sure they can say how right or wrong, Eddie.
All right, wrong. And yourselves. So what are we expecting the weekend? Win or lose, Eddie?
The weekend, if you asked me 3-4 weeks ago if Galway were playing a Connacht final against Mayo, I would have been thinking Galway at home to Mayo in a Connacht final. I would have fancied it after what they did in the league and the form they showed. However, since the resumption post-COVID, they have been struggling. I've been a little bit disappointed with them. Whether they're training hard and had expected Mayo to be coming in 4 weeks' time remains to be seen. I think Damien Comer is a big loss for Galway.
Is he definitely out?
I'd expect he is, yeah. Fully sure, but I'd expect he is. Galway need Shane Walsh to perform well to win on Sunday. Mayo have obviously played Leitrim. They played Roscommon. Leitrim was probably a tougher test than they expected. Roscommon, a good win for them. I think it's a big opportunity for both sides because the prize is Tipper Cork in a semi-final.
Hey, that.
But I do think, based on what we've seen the last 4 weeks, I'd have to think Mayo are in a better place and probably will win on Sunday.
Yeah, I think myself, I think Galway are going to be up against it. I think Aidan O'Shea full forward. We really have to sort that out in the full back line. I'd expect Mulkern will start. I expect maybe Liam Silk will pick up Killian O'Connor. I think, is Steed fit?
Yeah, I don't think so. And he's
I think we have a big loss around midfield. I think that's where we're struggling. We need a big game from Shane Walsh. I wonder, will he pull a Springer in the play Connor Sweeney at wing back? I wonder. I think like it would be a lot to ask a young fellow come in making his debut at wing back against Mayo. But I don't know. I think we're up against it, but it's Galway against Mayo, St. Pierre Stadium. We'll hope for the best. So what would you think? Michal Marahertie, Killian O'Connor kicks a point over at a minute to go, puts Mayo 2 points up. Bernie Power puts the ball in the tee. Take it away, Michal.
Do we have to go into Michal?
Go into Michal there for a minute.
Oh, I wasn't expecting this now. I usually do this in pubs, but I suppose.
Next best thing.
What did I say? The ball is down at the tee. It's played into Bernie Power. Bernie Power from Carafini's won 4 Club All-Irelands in the last 5 years. What a player is Bernie. Puts the ball out in the middle of the field and who rises highest is Cronin Steed from the Carafin Club. Steed back inside to Damien Comer, who we thought was injured earlier. Damien back into Shane Walsh. Shane Walsh is on the 50. He's on the 40. He's on the ground. It's a free in to Shane. A point is no good to Galway. He looks at the post. He looks at the ball, he knows he needs a score. If he misses this like Bat Simpson, he'll be in deep trouble. Play back inside to Shane Walsh. Shane Walsh to Damien Comer, back to Walsh. Walsh, what a player Shane Walsh has been. He's like a racehorse here in Croke Park. He's on the 50. He's on the 40. The ball is played back inside to Ian Burke, back to Walsh. It's in the back of the net and gone with the Connacht winners.
Come on, Eddie.
And Eddie, bye.
Very good. Very good.
Done better ones.
You're a massive catch.
Some men are consistent. Some men are brilliant. Shane Walsh, he's consistently brilliant.
Finish off. Paul, are you going to give a call for the weekend?
Bringing it back to a film we watched a few weeks ago, Miracle, and that match pre-Olympics between USA and the USSR. What is the similarities between that Galway Mayo game in the league and what's going to happen on Sunday in Salt Hill? You know, I think I think Galway obviously have to learn massively, but I don't think that they learn enough. I don't. They have to deal with Paddy Dorkin. I think everyone's struggling to deal with Paddy Dorkin for the last 2 years, and like in fairness, the inside line for Mayo are flying it at the moment, and that injection of the few new lads. And they talked about, at some stage there this week, they talked about the young lads. I think it was Killian O'Connor talked about them bringing a freshness and not being inhibited by, we'll say, history and having to stick to a structure. And I think Mayo will...
So what are you saying, Galway by 3?
I'm saying Mayo will win.
Massey, if he said anything else, he'd be getting a swift roundhouse kick to the jaw from his good wife.
She'd be right too.
Yeah, and I look. Right. You know what? I'd have been the same. I always have a soft spot for Mayo, and I think just watching him the other day with the young fellas they have in the team, but then Cork scored a goal in the last minute, and I start thinking in 1983 maybe it's destined for Dublin Galway final with a lot of fellas sent off.
So and the better outcome at the finish.
You can pick out who the three dirtiest players are that Dublin have that might be sent off, but we leave that open to viewers or listeners' discretion. Eddie, anything to plug before we go? Any votes coming up or anything you're
thoughts for? No, nothing, I suppose. Look, just to wish you all the very best with the podcast. I think it's a good concept, a good initiative, and something I most certainly enjoy taking part in, and I'd like to take part in going forward in a different capacity, if that's the case. But like I said, anytime you can talk GAA is a good time. So
Absolutely. Thank you, Eddie.
Thanks very much, Eddie. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Massey.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, all.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favourite platform. And if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo. We appreciate any likes, retweets, comments or feedback. Next week, we will be watching Mighty Ducks 2 and we'll have the show available first thing Tuesday morning as always. Thanks, everybody.